The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
First, I'd like to start by saying, telling you about a famous kind of simile. It's called a simile of the raft. And the Buddha said something like, if a person's walking through the jungle and they come to a big river that can't be forded, so the person finds a raft on this shore, and so the person gets on the raft and makes his way across the river with that raft, and then is going to walk through the jungle trail on the other side of the river. Would it be wise or foolish to then lift that raft up on the person's back and walk down through the jungle with the raft on the back? Well, the answer that's given in the texts is that it would be foolish to do that. You know, once the raft has gotten you across the river, then you leave it there for the next person to use it. It's a burden to carry it with you, you know, on your travels. So, in the same way, the Buddha said, I have taught that you should let go of all dharmas, even more so that which is not dharma, adhammas. And then there's been some discussion what exactly the word dharma means in this context. And one meaning that some people like is that dharma here means teachings, or not any kind of teachings, but Buddhist teachings. That the teachings of the Buddha are meant to be a raft. And you carry it has a function, it carries you across the river. And then once you've walked across the river, then you, by all means, you know, leave Buddhism behind. And I love this, you know, somehow the Buddhism self-destructs. You know, how many religions self-destruct? So it has its usefulness, but then, you know, at least theoretically, we leave it behind. And another meaning, another interpretation of this teaching is that it's not dharma, it doesn't mean teaching in this context, but it means qualities of mind. It's one of the meanings of dharma. And so the Buddha taught even wholesome, skillful qualities of mind should be let go of, even more so the unskillful ones, the unhelpful ones. And so that's a little bit more challenging, you know, unhelpful states of mind, I can understand letting go of that. I'm supposed to let go of the healthy ones too? What's that about? And one of the things it's about is that the experience of liberation, of freedom, is not conditioned on the particular states of mind that we have, or it's not created by the states of mind that we create. In fact, if we hold on to states of mind, then we stand in the way of becoming free. Creating good states of mind, like a concentrated meditation or a strong mindfulness, are all useful and important, but they have to be, in some ways, kind of let go of in order to have the experience of liberation, to be liberated, to be free. And part of the reason for that is that liberation is said to be it's unconstructed. It's something you can't construct. And many of us, you know, most of us, probably the mind, if you look carefully at your mind, you see your mind is always involved in constructions and making something happen. Thinking about things, wanting things, not wanting things, trying to figure things out. You know, there's often a general mood in many people's minds that can be seen as a certain kind of intentionality or motivation behind that mood. A mood of aversion or desire or apprehension or confusion or something. And so the mind is doing. And it's most clear, I think, when people sit down to meditate. And you try to quiet the mind in meditation, and it doesn't quiet so easily. And there's just a very strong momentum in the mind to do, to create, to build, to think, to do all this. And so liberation entails the complete stopping, or better word perhaps is putting to rest all this doing, all this construction in the mind. So it's said that the experience of liberation, or the event of liberation, is not constructed, it's unconstructed. It's the one kind of primary unconstructed state of being that the mind can be in. It's radically different than all the ways in which the mind is constantly doing and all that kind of activity. So there's a lot of then discussion about what exactly is this nirvana, this nibbana. And people really want to know. Because if I'm going to stake my life on it, you know, do all this work, I want to know what it is. You know, certainly there's all these its that my life is about. You know, its that are important are work or relationships or health or, you know, status or recreational opportunities or play or... There's a lot of its that people, you know... And so if you're going to not... If that's not going to be the ultimate, those kinds of usual conventional its, then whatever the other it's going to be, that it better be really good. And so I want to know what that it is. And so there's a lot of ink, Buddhist ink, that goes down trying to somehow explain what it is. And but it's possible there's not an it. So then, you know, if it's not an it, then, well, I'll stay with the its. So one of the meanings of nibbana, the Pali word is nibbana, the Sanskrit is nirvana, nibbana. One of the, the meanings, but the etymology of the word, ni means to free or to undo or something. And the vana part, vana, means can mean or to bind. It could also mean to cover over. And so nibbana is to unbind, is to uncover, or to release. Another etymology that people like, that's very popular for nirvana, is the etymology that means to extinguish a flame, a fire. So if you think of a fire as being like a fever that you want to kind of free yourself of, so it quenches or cools the fever of the mind. And so that which kind of quenches or extinguishes a fire. But the most popular etymology is to unbind. So it's kind of, so a kind of synonym of that is to release. And so in that sense, nibbana is not an it, but rather kind of in a certain kind of way, kind of an activity. It's like an action noun that means to unbind, to release. And then the question is, release into what? That's the it question. But the it, the what, seems very uninteresting to the Buddha. You know, I couldn't ask him. But if I read the teachings of the Buddha, it seems like he studiously tried to avoid saying what it is, what it's like to be liberated. What he talked about a lot was what it was like to be free and to be unbound of certain states. And so this movement of release, of unbinding. So some people talk about releasing the heart from everything that binds the heart, all the shackles of the heart. This is the movement of liberation, of nibbana. And then the very issue, oh, but, you know, I want an it. And I need to know it's it, you know. Without the right secure it, you know, who am I going to be? You know, and I can't tell my, show my parents, you know, that I've accomplished something. But that very movement to have it, to want it, to define it for me, that very thing is a form of being bound, of clinging. And so if the unbinding is going to be complete, then there has to be this releasing also of the very thing, of needing that thing, the it, the nibbana thing, to be something that we can show. Make some sense? So the Buddha talked then about, but he didn't not talk about it, but what he did was he talked about the process of this unbinding, of releasing, of freedom, of a lot from the point of view of what we get unbound from, what we get released from. So not what we get released into here, but rather what we're freed of. And I want to talk about a few of these today. What the Buddha considered to be the easiest things to be unbound of. Easiest doesn't mean easy. The easiest. And these are called three fetters or three knots that keep us bound, right? Three things that tie us down. And these are mostly the easiest things to undo are cognitive, have to do with understanding, how we understand this world, how we perceive and think about ourselves and the world. It's much harder to get down there below the cognitive level into our emotional life. So the first kind of movement towards this unbinding is kind of a certain kind of release that's more cognitive. And the first one is, I think, the most interesting. And the first one has to do with being released from the view, from the perspective, or having a view, a perspective, or the having an identity view. Sometimes it's called a personality view. I think it's a little bit confusing because of the way personality is used in English. But identity maybe is a little better for this. And this is having the view, the opinion, and operating from this view that who I really am is this particular identity, or some identity. And some of this is obvious, right? So some people have identities that they're a certain nationality. This is who I am. And, you know, and some of these nets, and once you have this identity of a nationality or, you know, ethnic group or gender or sexual orientation or class or many things, then a lot of other things follow. And some of the things involve a lot of suffering. And some of it come because other people share the identity. And so when people share an identity, then it kind of creates a kind of movement that's maybe not necessarily all inside of you, but leads to either suffering or happiness. And maybe this, I don't know if this is a good example, but a few weeks ago I went to my 10-year-old's baseball game that he was playing in. And I came a little bit late to the game, and I sat down in the bleachers of the opponent's team. You know, it's just other parents in Redwood City, right? The good people of Redwood City. And here I was sitting in the middle of the bleachers. And I thought, you know, great. I thought, fine, you know, I'm happy, but they make a score, you know, whatever. But after a while, I started feeling more and more uncomfortable. And so eventually I got up and went over to the other side. And so I was very aware that there was a social dimension of identity or kind of feeling connected of the group, you know, that it was quite powerful right there. The word that's translated into English as identity is sakya. And sakya comes from a compound meaning a satkaya, which means true body. So the idea that the view that this is the true body, this is who I truly am. And many people operate much of the time on this from this perspective of who they think they truly are. It can be a positive view, it can be a negative view, painful view to have. You know, I'm really great, and everyone should treat me that way. Or I'm really beautiful, or I'm really smart, or I'm really incompetent, or I'm really inadequate, or I'm really suffering. And to some degree, these things might have some truth to them. Some identities have some genesis in some kind of truth. For example, people have the identity that there might be a man, or there might be a woman, or some other gender. And you know, no one's going to take that away from you. It's accurate enough. But the view, the opinion, that my true body, who I really am, is defined by my gender, that is considered to be a form of delusion. Or to say a different way, that's something that people tend to cling to. And when you cling, it brings a lot of suffering, a lot of problems. So it isn't that you need to stop being a woman or a man or whatever, or stop assuming you are in some way, but it's the view to say, this is who I really am. This is my true identity. My true self is found in my gender. my true self, my true, I really am as an integral, essential person, is, and you can go through a long list. Each of you, hopefully, can be interesting to review the list of all the things that you have and do consider yourself to really be. And some of the stuff is somewhat unconscious or subconscious. Some of it's inherited from our society, from our family. Some of it comes from our life experiences. When I was in seventh grade, I took an art class. There was an art class to be taken. And I remember I was drawing. I was cupping my hand, my left hand with my right hand. And I noticed for the first time in my life there were all these lines in my hand. So I was kind of trying to draw all the lines. And the art teacher came over to me and said to me, you have no artistic ability. And, you know, I was in seventh grade, and I didn't care. I had no identity around being an artist or, I just and it didn't affect me in any kind of negative way, in the sense of I didn't feel bad or didn't feel depressed or upset. It's just, oh, this is the way the universe has been built, that Gil has no artistic ability. And so I just assumed, I took that on. And for the next probably 6 years, without any suffering whatsoever, I carried this view in my mind that who my true body was, who I really am, is I have no artistic ability. And then I had a roommate in freshman dorms college. He was a born again artist, and so I kind of he kind of pulled me into the fold. And by the end of the first year, I was taking art classes at college. So, it can be quite insidious, sometimes society and other people, impose identities onto us, and then we kind of believe them, we take them on as being true. So the first thing to be released from, the easiest, not easy, but the easiest, is to really be released from this idea that there's something defines who we really are as a person. So what are we then if we're not that? What are we if we're not going to define ourselves as essentially who we are by anything at all? It's a good question, because people really want to know who they are. And some people, it's very important to know who they are, they feel, because how else are they going to orient themselves with others? How else are they going to find themselves in relation to others in a healthy way? How are they going to feel safe, in relation to others, unless they have some sense of who they are, truly who they are? Some of this has to do with the confusion between a general sense, kind of a practical sense of what's here, and this view, this is who I really am. One of the things the Buddha taught is that the experience of liberation, he emphasized sometimes, the experience of liberation is found through a mindfulness of the body, he said a few different times, through mindfulness of the body. And I like this because the body is something concrete and immediate and right here. Or he talked about liberation found through the four foundations of mindfulness, being aware of your body, your feelings, your mental states, the activities, the processes of your mind. There was an emphasis in really knowing what's here, being very connected to what's here. So it isn't some kind of, oh, there's no true identity to who we are, and therefore let's just kind of be space cadets. It's kind of just, I don't know who I am, I don't know who you are, and we're just kind of, there's no thing to really identify with, so I hardly know, what I'm feeling, and, I hardly know that you're there, so I roll over you. But rather, there was an expectation of a very high degree of personal mindfulness, high degree of awareness of what's here, of the motivations that drive us, of the thoughts that we feel, the beliefs that come up, the bodily sensations, the body, what goes on with us. So it's really connected. And in that context of being really connected and grounded here, and that, so a person really knows, in a conventional way, we say a person really knows themselves well. Buddhists wouldn't say they know themselves well as a real essential self. They know all what's going on here, all these processes and thoughts and feelings. They're just not inclined to pull it all together and say, this is who I essentially am. And I think probably many of you have had the experience of shifting identities over a lifetime. Sometimes some identities were pretty solid for who you were at particular stages of your life. And pretty important that you had that identity, you succeeded in that identity. And then things change over lifetimes. You're no longer someone's child, or you're no longer, now you're a parent, or now you're not a parent, or now you're working, or now you're retired, or many things change. You're healthy, now you're not healthy. And that the whole idea of health and lack of health is a very important place that people establish an identity very, very powerfully. Some people find that being really seriously sick, in retrospect, after a while, some people will sometimes report, that was really one of the best things that happened to me, because the limitations it put me under forced me to see all the ways I was attached to a certain identity. And it freed me from that identity, freed me from that attachment to that. So occasionally there can be this benefit in being, have some really serious limitations in your life, not be able to follow through on the expectation who we think we need to be, or we want to be. Some people who've grown up in different cultures and speaking different languages sometimes can feel they're a different self almost, a different, different kind of person, different personality almost, depending which language they speak. I grew up speaking a number of languages, and I remember, when I was 19, clearly feeling there were some ways of being in the world, expressing myself in the world, certain things I could only say in Italian. The English Gil, English speaking Gil, just couldn't get to it. And I've watched other people too. It almost seems like a different personality, depending which language they speak. People have really grown up in different cultures. So who are we really? So there can be both a conscious and an unconscious, very strong drive to identify, this is who I really am. And seeing through that is the first task of liberation. And it's not seeing through it through logic, but rather seeing through it by looking, by kind of seeing through it, to really see it for what it is. To really see the identity of you arising in the mind. And then seeing, oh, look at that, it's a you. There's a series of thoughts being, words being put in the series. There's a view, an idea. And now with that idea in place, other things are following. If you can see the view arise, then you have the opportunity to question the view. Is that really true? Is that really who I am? Do I really want to act on this? If you don't see it arise, then it can seem like a just integrated part of the universe. This is how things are. And so one of the advantages, one of the possibilities of mindfulness meditation is the mind gets quiet enough to be able to see the arising of these thoughts, these ideas, these identities. And in seeing their arising, you can also see their emptiness of them. You can see maybe the arbitrariness of them sometimes. You can also see their usefulness. Sometimes you're useful to have certain kind of identities if you hold it lightly, like put on a coat. But you can see it come. And also you can see it go. And one of the very interesting questions is, who are you when you're not telling yourself a thought of who you are? If you're not going to use your thinking to tell yourself who you are, then who are you? You don't disappear. You don't die. Because you're not telling yourself a story, this is who I am. You're alert, you're present, you're here. There's no need to add a label. There's no need to add a story, an identity, to that sense of clarity, of presence, of just being here. So if you see the arising of this identity view, you see it's, how arbitrary it is, or ephemeral it is, or conventional it is, constructed it is, and you see the passing of that view, you see that there is a possibility of being without it. And as we see the arising and passing of it, at some point we can see that all the views, all the identities, all the grasping for that stuff is not needed. Doesn't really define, not really adequate or useful to define who we really are. And so then the mind, which is so tricky, will say, yes, I understand all this, but then who am I really? You know, if I'm not all these things, then I really need to know who I really am. And one of the great answers that some people like to have is, who I really am then is I'm the awareness that knows all that. That's who I really am. I think the Buddha would say that's just another form of identity view, attachment to a view. Now the view is that awareness is self. So who am I? Well, the drive to want to know who I am is, you know, if there's suffering connected to it, then we're bound. It's a form of clinging. And the practice of liberation is to free ourselves of clinging. So we have to also, sometimes it's very hard to, like that last lingering doubt or concern, well, you know, I really need to know who I don't realize I'm not all these things, but I really need to have, I need to be something. You know, you have to, you know, strive. It would be hard to let go of that as well, or relax that as well. And with time, that relaxes as well. And then there's this freedom from this identity view. And once a person has real confidence, has really seen through this, through and through, and has real confidence that nothing whatsoever can appropriately be taken as this is who I really am, my true identity, then the person begins to walk the path of liberation. And, you know, when there's a real seeing of that, and confident seeing of that. And then the other three of these ties, these fetters, also get released. Because the second one is the view that, to paraphrase a little bit, the view that virtue, rituals, conventional religious practices, social conventions are going to get you liberated. And you no longer, a person is freed from those views, from that view. Because they've seen that liberation does not come from this constructed activity through rites and rituals and magic and religious, you know, kind of mysticism and stuff like that, magical work, but rather it comes from this releasing of the holding, the release of the clinging. That's what it really takes. The Buddha said that liberation is to be experienced individually, experienced for oneself. It's not to be experienced through the medium of somebody else, not through the medium of some external thing, but something that happens internally through ourselves, through the release. So when a person is freed from this identity view, then that person tends to have a lot more confidence about what really is the path they have to follow. And this is really helpful because for Buddhists, because then you're not going to be so attached to Buddhism. You know, this idea of the raft, right? Buddhism has its usefulness, but you don't kind of like have this magical thinking about, oh, if I just get enough, you know, Buddhist accoutrements, just the right meditation bell and, you know, and the right Buddha and do the right chants and bow the right way and, you know, then I'll get it. That'll be, you know, it'll happen. Those things can be helpful, but that's not the heart of the path. And then the last of these knots has to, also they're all related, these last first three, is the person is released from doubt. Now the person no longer has any doubt about what is the path and what is not the path. So there's a tremendous confidence happens. So So they release from these things. Now, there's something very odd or funny that happens among these Buddhist types. And that is, well, first say that the Buddha occasionally said the person who has released themselves from these first three fetters has become a stream enterer. They entered the stream of the Dharma. You're kind of now going to be carried by the Dharma. You're carried in the Dharma from the practice stream. You're in the stream. You finally got to the water. You know, you're flowing along. You're in the path. So, there's a name for those kinds of people, a stream enterer. So then people want to know, am I a stream enterer yet? I'm a stream enterer. Yes, that's who I am. I'm a stream enterer. Wait a minute. The first fetter was this kind of identity view, defining something as who I really am. Poor Buddhists. And there's so much suffering in Buddhism among this Ligya, who is and who is not a stream enterer, who's gotten this. And that's not the point. The point is not to be something. The point is not to take some idea or something and say, this is who I really am. The point is not to live anymore holding on to, this is who I really am. But it can be really uncomfortable and really odd to be just there without needing that, well, this is who I am. So another way of talking about this is if you turn the attention 180 degrees around, away from the identities, away from all the things we hang our hat on, this is who I am, 180 degrees around, and look at what is it that you're hanging the hat on? What is it that you're putting that identity on? Turn around and look at that, you know, the very thing that wants to have an identity. It says, this is who I am. If you turn around and look at that thing, that whatever it is, and look at it really directly, chances are you won't find anything. There's no one to put the hat on. So to be liberated is to not have a hat stand. Or to realize there is none. So the idea of the raft, the idea is not to pick up a new raft, the liberated raft. Now I'm liberated. Yeah. People don't know about stream entry, will say, well, you know, am I liberated yet? Am I a liberated person? That person's liberated. I'm not. It's kind of, from the point of view of this process of freedom from identity view, that's the wrong question. It's completely uninteresting. To be grounded here and now in our experience, be present and alert and mindful of what's here, to be responsible for our feelings and our thoughts, reactions, motivations, to be connected and alert. And in that connectedness, to feel this tremendous, I should use these adjectives too lightly, but this clarity, this freedom, this openness of being, that doesn't have to be labeled or identified or made into something. Just be. It's a good thing too, because I was partly inspired to give this talk by listening to Ajahn Sumedho a few days ago. He calls it this identity view, he calls it a personality view. And he said, somewhat self-effacing manner about himself, he said, this personality of mine, this personality, it would never get enlightened. This personality would never do it. But it's not the personality that gets liberated. So isn't that great? And so the other thing that it kind of inspired me to give this talk today was, some people have seen I have the skin condition in my face. And the doctor says it's rosacea. I'm not really aware that I have it unless I look in the mirror. Or unless someone comes and says, what's that, Gil? I'm not defined by it. It's something that's there. Being free is not dependent on presence or absence of rosacea. So here we are. So I hope that each of you are challenged today to look a little bit at the things that you identify yourself as being. And it might be really interesting this week for you to go for a walk with some friends and explore this topic. Share with your friends some of the history you've had of things you've identified yourself as being over your lifetime, or things that you think that you are now. And even though you think, well, I really know that I don't really do that stuff. Just kind of, well, what might you be doing? What might be more unconscious? Or ask your friend, what do you think I'm identified as? Maybe you get a more interesting perspective then. What do you think and find out. Explore this. And then see, as you begin to really know this well, know it well first. Don't be in a hurry to get liberated. Know it well, really understand it well, and then put a question mark behind these. Begin questioning them. And try to see where they come from. And see if there's a whole other way of being in the world where you're not limited or defined by these identities. Set yourself free. Okay? Thank you.